Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you. First of all, thank you all for joining me. And I thought tonight we could talk about a Zen story. So I wanted to begin by really talking about a Zen story from my own heart. I thought, I have the case here, so I thought I could read it to you, but I thought that's going to be, I'd probably lose you. You know, in a way, it's nice to hear the case from the Blue Cliff record, but in another way, you can read it yourself in that book. So this is the first case. It's the highest meaning of the holy truth, in which you may already know this story, but in Zen we revisit stories over and over again. In this story, the master Bodhidharma came from India, came from the West to China, and he visited Liang, Kingdom of Liang, where Emperor Wu, who was called the Buddha Heart Emperor, was enthroned there. And Bodhidharma had an audience with him, and Emperor Wu said to him, "I have built many monasteries, and I have supported monks and taken care of the sick. What merit is there in this?" And Bodhidharma said, "No merit." So Emperor Wu was taken aback a bit, and then he said to him, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truth?" And Bodhidharma said, "Vast emptiness, nothing holy." And then the emperor said to him, "Who is facing me? Who is facing me? Who is speaking to me?" And Bodhidharma said, "Don't know. Don't know." So I will put to you with this. Bodhidharma raised the banner flag of the Zen school. He raised the Dharma flag. He bore his heart. He sang a song. He sang a song of freedom. Don't know. One can interpret this in many ways, but it's not a matter of interpretation. Bodhidharma said, "Don't know." This is the song of freedom. Don't know. In the commentary, when Bodhidharma said no merit, this was throwing dirty water on the emperor. It's kind of a, you know, in Zen we have kind of sometimes some kind of rude ways of saying things, you know. But to say throw dirty water on the emperor doesn't mean really throwing dirty water on the emperor. It means giving the emperor the very best thing that you have to give. There are many ways that, you know, I think if you consider your practice, you will find somewhere in yourself some knowledge of Bodhidharma's don't know, some knowledge of it. Some intimate knowledge of it. we experience this for ourselves. We come to practice for some reason. Each person has some reason why they come to practice. For me, I was studying at a yoga school, and it was a yoga school for yoga teachers, and I wanted to become a yoga teacher. And the first course that was offered was Zen meditation with Tenshin Reb Anderson. And so I thought, this looks interesting, and it's credit for my course. So I had this kind of this dual agenda of studying something interesting and fulfilling the obligations for becoming a yoga teacher. But very quickly, this turned into something else for me. It became the most important thing in my life. So how this happens is, and how it happens for each person is different, and what we make of it can be different. For many years, I tried to fit Zen into my conceptions of what it should be. And I continue to try to force reality into my conceptions of what it should be. But I know it's futile. It's futile. Don't know. Don't know. Recently, there was a series of articles in the New York Times on the decline of organized religion. Did anyone see that? It doesn't matter. True religion is not organized religion. Although one can express true religion within organized religion. Kodo Suwaki Roshi once wrote on a blackboard in a temple where he was teaching nuns, he wrote on the blackboard, "True religion is daily life." And one nun, seeing that, became his disciple and followed him and studied that for the rest of her life. True religion is daily life. When we sit zazen, what is it? Who is it? Who is sitting? What is sitting? What is the experience? For each person, it is unique and always changing. If we look at it from the standpoint of science, I like to look at science. I like to study. I like to try to understand what physicists say about our world. So physicists say that, you know, atoms are made up of protons and neutrons with electrons, and these make up molecules, and all of our bodies and everything in the world is composed of these atoms. And within each proton and within each neutron are three quarks and three gluons. So if you do a very simple calculation, you can figure out that this body contains something like 10 to the 29 quarks. That means one with 29 zeros after it. That's a very big number. Can you take it in? When we breathe in air, we're breathing in quarks and gluons and electrons. Even if it's particles of plastic that we're breathing in because we polluted the air, it's still quarks and gluons and electrons. If you're having difficulty with some person, that person you're having difficulty with is quarks and gluons and electrons. It's very strange when you think about it that way. Very odd. Scientists tell us our bodies are made of bacteria. Bacteria, and we have organelles, little captured single-celled organisms that used to be independent. They have their own DNA that's different from our DNA. They're in many of our cells. They produce ATP that we need for energy. We have killer T cells. We have the precept, do not kill. We have cells running around in our body killing things. You know? It's a strange world we live in. Overhead sometimes, not tonight, but sometimes we hear airplanes flying overhead. Do you ever think about it? You know, I didn't think about it too much until recently in my neighborhood. We were kind of a flyover area, and one of the neighbors got very upset about it and sent around an app telling us about an app, Stop Jet Noise. So I used this app for a couple of days, and you know, the thing was, it made me concentrate more on the planes than the rest of my life, so I stopped using it. But the thing that really got me about it is you could see this app would tell you what was the flight number, what was the airline, where were they going? You know, so then I started thinking, wow, up there, that plane is going overhead. Could be people coming or going from Taipei or Melbourne. You know, Hong Kong, Tokyo, Bakersfield. You know, it's an odd world we live in. It's very, very odd. But our way of experiencing it, even though I know this about quarks and gluons, it can still get thrown off very easily. And we shrink it down very, very small. And we become very tight. You know what I mean? We become tight. And we forget, don't know. Forget, don't know. And we think we know what practice is, and we're practicing the right way, and everything's going well. And then something happens, and we find out, wow, what was that? What did I just do? How did I just react? What's going on with me? You know? So, you know, Canon Do, the meaning of Canon Do is a place of compassion or way of compassion. So we practice Zazen, and that nourishes compassion. But because we're human beings and because we forget the vastness, we forget that we're little tiny beings circling a star that's 26,000 light years from the center of the galaxy. This galaxy is one of billions of galaxies. We're so small, so insignificant, but in our life, we're not insignificant. We see things, we experience our experiences very important to us, and we get caught very easily. I want to just give a kind of silly example from my own life. I think I already might have told Diane, I don't know. But you know, for the past 5 years, I've been taking care of my mother, who's 99, and she sometimes calls me in the night, Kathy, Kathy. You know, so I go into her room, which is hard sometimes because you're asleep and you don't really want to get up. One night I went in and she did this only once. She said, "I want you out of here. I want you out of here. You came here to take a vacation. I want you to grow up and get out of here." And I said, "What are you saying, Mom? I want you out of here." "I think you have to go back to sleep." And so, you know, we got through it. But I was reeling. I was reeling. But I didn't think. You know, my mother is 99. She's blind. She doesn't always know what she's saying or doing. She gets lost in time and space. I didn't think that. I thought about me, you know? And then later in the day, I found out she wasn't talking to me. She was talking to someone else who wasn't there. But in that moment, I was caught, you know? They say, if you think you're a good Zen student, you think you know the way of Zen, go home and spend a week with your family, you know? That's a saying. So I give that just as an example. But there can be other things that trigger us in other ways, and we can become really, really distressed, especially if there's a wound, if we have a wound. We can become distressed. We have precepts. Precepts are not, it can feel like precepts are like the Ten Commandments or something, but they're actually a little bit different. Precepts are for us. And I recommend to Zen students, whether they're lay students or priests, to learn the precepts, learn what they are, and just recite them to yourself every day. Call them to mind once a day. Not killing, not stealing, not lying, not misusing sexuality, not intoxicating body or mind of self or others, not slandering, not praising self at the expense of others, not being possessive of the Dharma or anything else for that matter, not harboring ill will, and not disparaging the three treasures. So why call these to mind? Are these appropriate for us in the 21st century? You can decide for yourself. As you call them to mind, you can go into them in great detail and kind of do an examination of conscience or examine your actions throughout the day or the month or the week, or consider. You can use them that way. You can study them that way. I actually find the most useful is simply to call them to mind. Just not. These are the precepts of restraint. Restraint. It's not about becoming a perfect person. These precepts are given to us for our freedom. For our freedom. Now, Suzuki Roshi said, "Don't kill is a dead precept. Please excuse me is a living precept. Please excuse me. That's a living precept. Please excuse me." You know? He also, in one of his lectures, he mentions that once there was a monk from India who traveled to China, but he found he couldn't keep the precepts as he learned them in India in China. So he went back to India. He didn't change his precepts to meet his situation. He went back to India. So any religion that holds to things in a really strict way becomes ossified. It becomes ossified. We have to my feeling is we have to have a Buddhism for the 21st century. We also have what's called the style of our school. Does anybody know the style of our school? What it's called? Menmitsu no Kafu. Suzuki Roshi translated this as a very careful and considerate style. If you bring these words to mind, the precepts all collapse down into this, a very careful and considerate style. We consider what we're doing. Is what we're doing beneficial? We consider who we're with. If we can remember and it's useful to us in that moment, we might think while standing in line at the checkout, wow, there's another universe of quarks right up there, you know? Our problems come from, said, beginningless greed, hate, and delusion. Beginningless. Scientists may say, oh, not so fast. 13.78 billion years ago was the Big Bang. So we'll start it then, okay? Okay. Okay by me. We'll start it then. What I'm saying is, we need to incorporate our modern world in our practice, but not in any kind of, how can I say it? I study quarks and gluons and things like that because it interests me. You may have no interest in it at all. But the question is, how do you open your mind when it's closed, when it's clamped closed? How do you open it? How do we let go of our story when we have a story that is causing us pain? When we have a story that is really causing us pain and causing other people pain, how do we let go of that story? This can happen between family members. It can happen between races. It can happen between genders. It can happen many ways. When I think about quarks and gluons, I think quarks, gluons, electrons, okay, you know. I don't see any problem there. Why do we get into so much trouble? Where does it come in? You know? But it does. That's our human destiny. The planet that we live in, our planet Earth, we are the most abundant species on the planet. We outnumber all the other animal species. And you notice I don't say all the animals, I say all the other animal species. Because we are animals too. And our behavior shows it. Has anyone seen the YouTube of the two bonobo monkeys, bonobos, primates? They're small primates, and we are very closely related to bonobo. We are very closely related to bonobos and chimpanzees. Those are the two we're most closely related to. Well, this experimental person offers two bonobos in adjacent cages pieces of cucumber. So they perform something and they get a piece of cucumber. So this is going on fine. And then the experimenter gives one a grape, but she gives the other one a cucumber. The one who gets the cucumber goes ballistic. Ballistic. Takes the grape and throws it at the experimenter with great energy. It's not fair. It's not fair. No, we're not so different. We're not so different. We talk about mind. This is Zen school, mind only. Mind only, everything being mind, you know? It's a philosophy one can study. But then one can also look at what a physicist has to say about it. The physicist Richard Feynman. He says, a scientific article may say radioactive phosphorus content in the cerebrum of a rat decreases by one half in a period of 2 weeks. So they put radioactive phosphorus, the rat's brain, they put some radioactivity in there so they can detect the phosphorus, and then they say it decreases by half in a period of 1 week. So Richard Feynman says, it means that phosphorus that is in the brain of a rat and also in my brain and your brain is not the same phosphorus as it was 2 weeks ago. Not the same. It means the atoms that are in the brain are being replaced. The ones that were there before have gone away. So what is this mind of ours? What are these atoms with consciousness? He says, last week's potatoes, that's what they are, okay? They now can remember what was going on in my mind a year ago, a mind which has long ago been replaced. To note that the thing I call my individuality is only a pattern or a dance. That is what it means when one discovers how long it takes for the atoms of the brain to be replaced by other atoms. Atoms come into my brain, dance a dance, and they go out. There are always new atoms, but always doing the same dance, remembering what the dance was yesterday. So that's our human experience, isn't it? We try to understand this issue of not self, and yet we remember from the past. We remember. This this don't know. This can be seen and expressed in many ways, you know. In the Genjo Koan, Dogen Zenji says, when you first seek Dharma, you imagine that you are far from its environs. But Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are your original self. Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are your original self. What is that self? Don't know. Because of our tendencies, we call it something. We put something on it. And of course, we have a driver's license, we have relatives, we have friends, we have our dignity, we have our delusions of grandeur. But this don't know is grander than anything else we could possibly imagine. Don't know. Later in the Genjo Koan, says something like, when Dharma does not fill your body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma does not fill your body and mind, you think it is already sufficient. When Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. You understand that something is missing. Now, for the longest time, I thought this meant something like, it means something missing is my practice. I'm not practicing right. That's what I thought it meant. That's what I thought it meant. But that's not the meaning. You can tell clearly by what he says next, you know? For example, when you sail out in the midst of an ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. Although they may look round or square, the other features of the ocean are infinite in variety. Whole worlds are there. It is so not only around you, but also directly beneath your feet or in a drop of water. Fish swims like a fish, and no matter how far it swims, there is no end to the water. A bird flies like a bird, and no matter how far it flies, there is no end to the air. But the fish and the bird have never left their element. You've never left your element. I've never left my element. When their need is small, their field is small. When their need is great, their field is great. Each of them covers its full range. Each of them totally experiences its realm. You know, we can study the Genjo Koan and think, yeah, I studied the Genjo Koan. I'm done with that. But never done with the Genjo Koan. Never. You know, one ongo at Tassajara, Linda Ruth Kutz was leading it. And she encouraged us to memorize the Genjo Koan. And so one personal day, 4 9 days, the day when we didn't have such a big Zendo schedule. It happened that it snowed. This was very unusual at Tassajara. It snowed maybe 3 or 4 inches. It was very heavy snow. And I walked down to the bathhouse and took a bath. And I had an umbrella, a big umbrella. And I had a copy of the Genjo Koan with me because I was trying to memorize it. And when I came out of the bathhouse, I decided to hike up to the Suzuki Roshi Memorial and study the Genjo Koan up there, try to memorize it, work on memorization. So I felt strange disturbing the snow, but I did it, and I walked up there. And I stood there in front of the rock on Suzuki Roshi Memorial, and I was reciting the Genjo Koan to myself. And I don't know how long I was doing that, but then suddenly I realized a bird sang, but I couldn't tell. When did it sing? Did it sing a minute ago, half an hour ago? I couldn't tell. It was a strange feeling. And then I heard the water, because the snow was melting and it was dripping from the trees, drilling holes in the snow. The Genjo Koan was completely alive, completely alive. But we forget. We get caught by our problems. So we have the verse of confession and repentance. All my ancient twisted karma from beginningless greed, hate, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. It's powerful. It's powerful. I don't know if I've correctly conveyed what I was trying to convey about the precepts and how they are for us. They are for the practitioner. It seems like it can be like a straitjacket or something, but it's the vehicle for how to live without harming. Without harming others, but also without harming ourselves. How to find peace in this moment. How to be peaceful in any situation. It's not easy. So we have to forgive ourselves. We have to ask forgiveness of others. And sometimes we have to step back from our role. If we have a role, it requires us to always be present to everyone with the kindest mind, and we can't do it, we need to step back and take a break. We need to take a break. How long a break? I don't know. Long enough to recover. So when we enter Bodhisattva's don't know, what can we trust? Can we trust not knowing? Sometimes that can be a little frightening. To trust not knowing can be a little frightening. Suzuki Roshi said, I trust my black cushion. I trust my black cushion, and I trust my feet. When I'm walking, I trust my feet. You know? One Zen master quoted by Nishihara Bokuzan, quoted a Zen master as saying, I have a great power. When the wind blows, I fall down. Isn't that beautiful? A great power. When the wind blows, I fall down. Oh, wow. So I think I want to quit because talking in just a minute, so there's maybe a couple questions anyway. I just want to give you one more quote from Richard Feynman. Because I think Richard Feynman and Bodhidharma would have gotten along quite well. And this is quoted by James Glick. He wrote a biography of Richard Feynman called Genius. And he quotes this at the very, very end of the biography. You see, one thing is, I can live with doubt and uncertainty and not knowing. I think it's much more interesting to live not knowing than to have answers which might be wrong. I have approximate answers and possible beliefs and different degrees of certainty about different things, but I am not absolutely sure of anything, and there are many things I don't know anything about, such as whether it means anything to ask why we're here and what the question might mean. I might think about it a little bit, and if I can figure it out, then I go on to something. If I can't figure it out, then I go on to something else. But I don't have to know the answer. I don't feel frightened by not knowing things. by being lost in a mysterious universe without having any purpose, which is the way it really is so far as I can tell. It doesn't frighten me. Thank you. I think we have a few minutes. Any questions people would like to raise or comment? Does anybody have anything they'd like to say?
Probably will raise their little yellow hands. I want to say thank you for bringing up these things about quarks and gluons and all of these things you said. I remember reading somewhere, I have always been really interested in particle physics and knowing what the universe is made of and stuff like that. But I remember reading somewhere that because we're made up of these tiny particles whirling around, there's basically a lot of space within us. And it's as if, you know, like if a good wind came by, would actually be blowing right through us, because these tiny particles that make up our bodies have a distance from each other that's probably equivalent from Earth to the moon, you know, between two particles. So I imagine when I'm walking on a windy day, just imagine the wind could actually be blowing right through me, you know, and it kind of lightens up your seriousness about all the things that you worry about on a daily basis. I thank you for kind of bringing that in to the discussion.
They may not have heard Kathy. May not have heard her. If you want to repeat what she said.
Repeat the comment. The gist of Lee's comment, I can't really repeat the whole thing, but the gist of it, she was sharing that she also likes to study particle physics, that to try to understand what the physicists are saying. And she was mentioning we have a lot of empty space in us. I think I've heard that the proton or the nucleus of the atom is to the electron cloud like a pinhead to a baseball field. So there's a lot of empty space there, and she likes to imagine on a windy day with the rain that the wind or the rain might be going right through her, something like that. Yeah. Well, yeah. We do have neutrinos traveling through us all the time.
Thank you for the talk. From that space of not knowing or feeling uncertainty, right, it's being like a basic fabric of your life, you can appreciate that, or I can appreciate that sometimes, but yet you're called on to act in many situations. And so any advice on how to act? Because we often act from thinking that we know, or we're taking the best shot of what we think we know, or what would be right, or what I should do now. And so any advice on how to act, but yet, because it's necessary, but yet maintain that sense of not knowing, I guess.
So the question here is, we have to act. So we might be able to have some sense of not knowing, but we have to act. So any advice on how to do that? This is a koan. This is the koan of our life. How to act. This is why I was suggesting we need a Buddhism for the 21st century. So, as I said, I suggest bringing the precepts to mind. Because if you do that, and I don't mean, you know, like, what can I say, you're in some dynamic situation, most likely you're not going to be thinking about the precepts, and you're going to be thinking about whatever's going on, or you're going to be reacting, something's going on. So my experience is that by bringing the precepts to mind once a day, I have more of a feeling of things I don't want to do. And how does that help us when we act? Well, when I might say something to somebody because I'm unhappy with what they're doing or not doing, I might suddenly have something come to mind about the precepts. It just comes to me because I've reflected on it at a different time, or because I brought it to mind at a different time. You know, once when I was at Tassajara and I was in study hall, we had study hall every day, and I looked up and there was some person at a table a little ways from me, and I was starting to form a thought about them, and all of a sudden it was like a thought bubble appeared above their head, and it said, "Keep your concepts off of me." It just came like that. It came. So you know, I talk about quarks and gluons and those kinds of things. But, you know, if we're practitioners, whatever we think about, in some sense, we're aiming for the fabric of our life. Our interests are coming from our deepest questions. So if I say somebody else is also quarks and gluons, you really can't grasp it. You know, you can't get it. But there's some inkling there. It's like, this person is not so different from me. You know, this person I'm having a hard time with, that I see all the things they're doing wrong. What if I start noticing what they're doing right? What if I start paying attention to that instead? You know. Other things, you know, we have to make our own choice. So, for example, climate change. There's one. Climate change. You know, how do we deal with that? You know, that's a con. From the precepts, how do we deal with that? I hope I've given you a little bit of food for thought there. Hi, please. Dave.
David, yes, thank you. I'm applying to a continuing care retirement community, so I have a place to go and be surrounded by friends and be well taken care of until I die. It's a very stressful application process, and it's almost monstrously expensive. It has occurred to me that I'm paying a lot of money to try to control and define my environment for the next couple years against this whole drama of not knowing, of not really being in control of my old age and death. Have you had experience with how older people react or deal with the not knowing situation? It seems to me as it's getting more and more stressful, the not knowing, as I get older. Your experience would help me a lot. Thank you.
That's a great question. And my experience with older people is mainly with my mother, who's 99, and she can't see, her hands don't work, and the world is very confusing for her. And at times she's quite fearful. So you know, the thing is, when we grow old, we are really not in control, because I would say the thing we can do is take care of our own bodies and mind as we're growing older. And then with other old people who are near us, we can be as kind as we can be. With my mother, lately, often what I do at night when she calls me is I climb into bed with her and I lie next to her for a couple of minutes, warm body against warm body. The first time I did it, I think she was taken aback. But then she kind of, after I did it a couple of times, I said, is that enough snuggling? And she said, more. So that's something we can give another person. We give ourselves. So we don't know if that will be there for us. So taking care of ourselves, like, you know, if you're in a good facility and all of that, that's important, because that's not just for yourself. You know, Dogen said in the Dogen Zenji in the fascicle, the Bodhisattva's four methods of guidance. The first one is giving. And he's saying to give to oneself is also a form of giving. That's also giving. So to take care of oneself and to give to oneself in that way, that's important. But then to notice around us, you know, there may be somebody we can do something for. But we, you know, we're finite beings. So what we can do, I mean, you know, Avalokiteshvara, you know, it said he has these thousands of heads, you know, it said because he emptied out Avalokiteshvara, she emptied out hells, the hell realms. And then she turned around to look at the hell realms and they were all filled up again. And her head split open in grief. You know, there's so much suffering. There's so much suffering in the world. So we try to do something. You know, we try to do something for someone near us. And then for ourselves, we try to take care of our diet, you know, get a little exercise, you know, try to do something for our brain, those kinds of things. Yeah.
But thank if you we very much. Others,
maybe it'll become a movement.
Very helpful. Very helpful. Thank you.
You're welcome. Candy. Hello.
I love your comment to Dave. It is so important to help other people who are aging, because it helps us understand ourselves, and because we know we're going to be going through that process also. And I told an elderly neighbor of mine many years ago, she was despairing of growing old and what was she going to do, and I said, oh, Mary, don't think like that. You are my teacher. You are going to show me how to grow old gracefully. You're the most graceful person I know, and you are a great teacher to me. Look at all the things that you have taught me so far. And she says, oh, I didn't realize. Okay. It gave me a whole new meaning for that relationship. It was wonderful. But I wanted to make another comment about your talk. And this is my comment. I was thinking of all the corks standing in line at the cash register. And then all the corks flying in planes over our heads. What noisy corks.
What was the last line?
What noisy corks.
What noisy corks, indeed, indeed. it's just quirks, and yet, yeah. Thank you.
About the koan, the Bodhidharma.
Mm.
As I remember it, after that interaction, Bodhidharma goes and sits in a cave, I think it was 7 years or something like that.
9 years.
9 years?
Yeah. Shaolin Temple.
At Shaolin.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in hearing what you have to say about that aspect.
Oh. Fortunately for me, it's 9 o'clock. I get off the hook. So Bodhidharma leaves the kingdom of Liang and travels to the kingdom of Wei and sits in a cave for 20 years facing a wall, or 9 years facing a wall. And you know, in the Fukan Zengi, is the fame of Bodhidharma's wall sitting is celebrated to this day. Fame of Bodhidharma's 9 years of wall sitting is celebrated today. Tim was saying that maybe Bodhidharma's 9 years of wall sitting, maybe his don't know, was a kind of confession, and that his 9 years of wall sitting was his expression of commitment to practice, to continue practicing. And the curiosity. I have to confess that I have this thought, which is just my thought, but that Bodhidharma didn't know, doesn't know. Bodhidharma is totally confident in not knowing. That Bodhidharma had complete confidence in not knowing. Complete confidence. For myself, to have complete confidence in not knowing, if I said so, I would be praising myself and it wouldn't be accord with my day-to-day experience. I wouldn't be getting caught, you know? So it could just be my I don't think it's so bad to think that there are people who understand practice a lot better than I do. I think that's pretty good, you know? Not that I trust their practice, the way they practice, more than I trust the way I practice. You know, you have to sit where you are. You can give a teacher too much, whether it's Bodhidharma or anyone else. And not trust yourself enough. Well, we're a little bit past 9, I think, so maybe that's enough questions for tonight.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.